The difference is not even the whether it's girly or manly. It's whether hymns talk about what we're going to do.
Right.
Praise songs talk about how we feel. And, you know, men tend to be more mission-oriented. Women tend to be more feeling-oriented, emotion-oriented. Women feel comforted when they have all their people around them and everyone's doing well. Men feel comforted when they know what they're out to achieve. I know these are huge, you know, generalizations, and there are women who are mission-oriented, there are men who are feeling-oriented. But having said that, the majority of men are going to feel comforted when they know what their mission is.
Welcome to the Empowered Manhood Podcast, where men rediscover courageous masculinity. Pull up a chair as we gain strength from the stories of God working in the lives of ordinary men today. These men have discovered that in a world of superficiality and isolation, we need authentic brotherhood to gain strength for the battles we face every day. Brought to you by the ministry of CLC, which challenges men to an uncommon pursuit of Christ, welcome to Empowered Manhood. Hey, welcome back to the Empowered Manhood Podcast. My name is Mike Hatch, and I am here, as usual, with Chris Bollinger, author of the Daily Strength for Men devotional and co-host with me now on this podcast. Chris, it's good to have you with me again.
Hey, Mike. Great to be here.
Today, we have another special guest. Really excited for this. David Murrow is with us. David, thanks for joining us today, man.
I'm glad to be here as well.
Yeah. And so I was doing a little bit of research, and you've written a couple books. I think when I counted, there might've been five. Yeah. I was going to guess five. That's right. But it's interesting. You just started doing some research and, about men in the church, which led you to write Why Men Hate Going to Church. And it became an inspirational bestseller. You sold more than 100,000 copies, 100,000 copies in print, I believe.
There's 200,000 now. It keeps rolling on in 12 languages.
Okay. Wow. Oh, that's amazing. Wow. Fantastic. And of course, these efforts led to being on the New York Times and Wall Street Journal and Chicago Tribune, just to name a few. Mm-hmm. Not to mention PBS, NBC Nightly News, Fox News Channel, talking about Christianity's gender gap, actually, specifically. And you hail from Texas originally, but live in Alaska currently. Is that correct?
Where men are men, yes.
Yeah. And that's not even a joke. A buddy of mine just came back from Alaska and said how brutal it was there.
Yeah, we kill things for dinner.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You are a television producer and writer by trade. You've worked in just about every channel on the dial, from ABC to the Travel Channel. Mm-hmm. The other thing I saw was that one of your specialties was political advertising. That was very interesting.
Yeah, little known fact, I actually produced Sarah Palin's very first television commercial when she was running for lieutenant governor in 2002, and then I later served on her staff. So, I mean, we may not be in lockstep politically, but it was a very interesting ride to see her rise.
Yeah, that's incredible. Wow. Of course, you are married to Gina now since 1984, three children, two grandchildren.
And no, that's an old, I got seven.
Oh, it is.
Now. I got seven. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. See, okay. Yeah. Occurring. So this is an older, this is older information. Well, David, thank you for being with us. And today we really want to talk about, that first book, Why Men Hate Going to Church. Yeah. And let's start by, first of all, just kind of asking what for you prompted the writing of that book.
Well, as you mentioned, I'm a media professional. I work in the television business. And one of the first things you learn when you're doing commercials or specials or programs is there's a target audience for every channel on the dial and every program on that channel or every commercial. And I was just sitting in church one day and realized the target audience of my church was a middle-aged woman. The way the church was decorated with quilts and flowers and ribbons and felt banners and child style construction paper, bulletin boards. It just had the feeling of an elementary school. Mm. And the church was wearing a robe and stole, and there was, you know, flowers and candles, and all the opportunities were, the volunteer opportunities were cooking and teaching and caring for children and caring for the sick. And, you know, I'm just sitting here thinking, oh, my gosh, you know, this whole enterprise is targeted at a woman and has almost nothing to animate the heart of a young man. So that's kind of what started my journey. And then I'd always noticed that almost every gathering, anytime I gathered with other Christians, the gender ratio was usually 60-40. So I started doing some research thinking I was going to do a documentary because I'm a filmmaker. But I got some really good advice to go ahead and put it down in a book, and off it goes. Then the rest is history. And then, you know, 2 weeks later, the New York Times is featuring it, and it got a lot of media attention. The president of Promise Keepers invited me to come to one of his rallies and say, what are we doing wrong here? You know, how can we make this, you know, it was a meteoric rise in the mid 2000s. And, you know, I'm sad to say that, you know, 16 years after the publication of the book, we're still fighting this. We still have a gender gap. Women are dropping out of church at a faster rate than men now. However, the gap persists. So it's definitely a problem that we need to keep our eyes on.
Dave, had you been in church most of your life at this point when you first realized this? And what do you think prompted you to realize something that you probably had witnessed for a long time, just never really been aware of it?
Well, I had, you know, bumped in and out of church when I was a little kid, became a follower of Jesus, you know, got saved at 15, and then got really serious about my faith after that, and attended a Christian college, Baylor University, where, you know, Christianity was everywhere. And that's when I really started to begin to notice that there was sort of a feminine feel to a lot of what we did. It was just at the beginning of the praise and worship movement. And a lot of the songs, the sentiments, the old hymns, you know, Onward Christian Soldiers, it kind of had that battle feel. Those were being replaced by, you know, Jesus, I'm so in love with you. And it had this dreamy romantic feel. And I began to realize, and then I also did an internship at Word Records, which was one of the, you know, Amy Grant and a lot of the big Jesus music stars of the 70s and 80s were published on Word Records. And, you know, I just began to notice that so many of our products kind of had that breezy feminine feel. They were really targeted more at women than men. There really was no men's ministry material at all in the 80s. It simply didn't exist until two men, Pat Morley and Edwin Lewis Cole, came out with books. Pat Morley wrote Man in the Mirror, and Edwin Lewis Cole wrote Maximized Manhood. And those were really the first two men's ministry books. So then Promise Keepers came along in the 90s, and the profile of men's ministry really increased. But yeah, back in those early days, I began to notice that everything in the church was being skewed toward women because women bought most of the Christian products.
Interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask you, what was it, do you think historically it kind of led to church being so feminized?
Well, it's feminization has come and gone over the years. The most recent wave of feminization began in the Victorian era when economic conditions changed and large numbers of able-bodied men went off to work in mines, mills, and factories, and they left their families behind. And so what you had is an attendance profile in the local church of women, children, and aged men. And that pattern persisted all the way through World War I and World War II. Church attendance hit its low point during the Great Depression. Men were scrapping for work. They were trying to find work wherever they could. Women were left home to take care of the church. In post-war America, we had the resurgence of church attendance. We had the joiner, the builder generation. They joined everything. They joined Kiwanis clubs, Rotary, and they joined their local church. And so we saw this huge resurgence of men. Church attendance reached its absolute peak. Mission work was at its peak. It was a really excellent time for the church. But then we began to see male attendance tail off, particularly in the mainline churches, which began to skew very liberal in the 70s. They became hotbeds of anti-war activism. They opened their governing boards to women, and they brought in more feminism and sort of some anti-men attitudes. And so we began to see men withdraw from those institutions. And that's what we find ourselves today, is in a situation where young Christians, having never seen a committed Christian man, are deconstructing their faith. In large part because, especially boys, because they have no idea what a Christian man looks like. They've never really seen one other than a pastor who gets paid to be a Christian.
Yeah, I'm just curious. So churches had a lot of men after World War II, and you said that in the mainline churches, they tended to skew more liberal at that point and began to lose their men. What happened in the non-mainline churches? Do we see similar trends there, or have they been able to retain the men more?
No, the sort of the non-denominational movement has been very successful at reaching men. The two of the great pioneers of that movement were men by the name of Bill Hybels, who in 1975 went door to door and asked people why they didn't want to go to church. And he found that most of the resistance was among the men. And so he created a mythical churchgoer called Unchurched Harry. And they focused their entire building, their music, their preaching, the building, the decor, everything was focused on getting that guy in the door, realizing that if you got him in the door, you'd get the family in the deal. 5 years later, a penniless Baptist preacher by the name of Rick Warren established Saddleback Church, and he did the exact same thing. He created a mythical parishioner called Saddleback Sam.
Right.
And Saddleback Sam was his target. He didn't bother going after the women and children. He knew they would come. If he could get the guy in the pew, he knew that he would get the rest of the family in the deal. So these non-denominational churches, whether they realize it or not, have been targeting men for 40 years, and they've grown. They've become much more influential. Their budgets have grown. Their attendance has grown. Their influence over the publishing industry has grown. It's been very, very healthy. It's been a resurgence of what I would call the masculine spirit in the church. They've remained, most of them have remained politically conservative, theologically conservative, excuse me, and politically too. But the theological orthodoxy and conservatism appeals to men who are more concerned with, I have a maxim. I would say men will sacrifice relationships on the altar of rules, whereas women will sacrifice rules on the altar of relationships. And so churches that are theologically orthodox, that have strong rules, attract men. Those who will bend the rules in order to accommodate relationships are more attractive to women, particularly older women. And so this is the attendance pattern that we see in our churches today. The liberal churches are run by grandmas, and the conservative churches are run by young firebrand men.
Interesting. Do you think, because with the non-denominational, or sometimes referred to as interdenominational churches, there's also this church planting movement that happens often out of that. And I've heard it said before, and I guess I'm asking if you find this to be true as well, that in church planting, do you see a lot of men involved in that?
Absolutely. Almost every church planter is a man. With a beard, and like 17 kids. No, it is true. Most of the revitalization efforts and planting efforts are spearheaded by men. It's interesting. Religion News Service, which is a very liberal religion outlet, just did a story on six female church planters of color, and their theology was just so, you know, BIPOC, Black Lives Matter, LGBTQ, no, nothing about, you know, personal transformation or whatever. It was just so lefty. You could just tell these churches weren't going to get any traction because they're never going to appeal to a young man. That's not why he comes to church. You know, young men come to church for transformation. They come for miracles. They come for strength. They come for to bring order to their disordered lives. They want Jordan Peterson, you know. They don't want Mother Teresa comforting them. Yeah. So I think the church planting movements has been led by men primarily because they appeal to young men, and the young men are the key demographic that you have to get into the door if you want to build a sustainable church. You know, it started with Jesus. Jesus went out and found six men, six women, and he started a children's ministry, right? No, he went out and found 12 dirty guys off the street and built the organization that literally changed history.
Hey guys, this is Mike Hatch. Thank you so much for listening to Empowered Manhood. And of course, this is brought to you by CLC, Christ-Led Communities, where we help busy pastors multiply their impact by engaging the men in their church through relational discipleship. We challenge men to an uncommon pursuit of Christ, and we equip men to be leaders based on a growing, vibrant relationship with Jesus and a dedication to sound biblical principles. If you would like to learn more about CLC, you can visit our website at clchq.org. That's clchq.org. Or you can also email me at mhatch@clchq.org. Again, that's mhatch@clchq.org. All right, now let's get back to the interview.
That's Dave, great. You wrote the book initially in 2005, had a lot of success. I think you redid it in 2011 or so.
That's correct, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about how things changed for you. So had you been involved in men's ministry before you wrote the book? You mentioned that it wasn't real strong at your church and not real strong at a lot of churches. So what changed for you? You wrote this book, had a huge impact. What have you seen on the men's ministry front since writing the book initially in 2005? And how have you been involved in that?
Well, what I've seen is the high water mark of men's ministry was probably the Stand in the Gap, Promise Keepers, 1997, 7 years after the first Promise Keepers rally. Enthusiasm began to tail off after that. Promise Keepers made a catastrophically bad decision in 1998 to stop charging admission to their stadium events, thinking that would increase attendance. It suppressed attendance. One of the things you learn in men's ministry is if you don't charge men a little bit of money, they won't show up. Mm-hmm. And so Promise Keepers learned that the hard way. But there have also been several high-profile flameouts of men in church who have abused women. And feminist groups have latched onto this, and they have brought a lot of dishonor to men's ministry. They've made it seem creepy. And there's just not a lot of pastors now who, look at the continued crucifixion of Mark Driscoll. Driscoll was probably the most effective pastor to men we had in the early 2000s. He admittedly had some missteps there, some sin in his life, was forced to step down. His ministry was dismantled. It was an ugly, ugly scene. But it served as a cautionary tale to other pastors who might want to aggressively reach out to men. You don't touch this third rail, or they'll find some dirt on you and they will put you under it. And so, I think the final nail in the coffin of men's ministry was the Church Too movement, which came out of the Me Too movement. There has been a lot of energy against men in the church to accuse men of being abusers. And what's interesting is no women have really stood up in their defense. I follow a lot of Christian women's sites on social media, and they are uniformly negative toward men, how abusive Christian men are, how the church enables abuse, how Christian men are just the worst. They're just awful. You'd do better to marry a non-Christian. Even some of them even go as far as to say that. So, there's definitely a tide against men's ministry right now. And it's just going to, I think that fire is just going to have to burn itself out. And then enough women are going to realize, you know, maybe we've overdone this here in trying to root out abusive men. We have turned all men off the church, and we need to do something, including our sons. And we need to do something about this, because nothing in the church happens without the authorization of women.
Okay, David. So we get all kinds of listeners. Some of them are church staff folks. So we've got pastors, men's ministry leaders, and so on. You know, they feel you're right. I mean, they understand this, they see it firsthand. So help them out. What are some things they can do on a week in, week out basis that will begin to attract more men and energize the men, activate the men, get the men involved in the life of the church, as well as more active in pursuing Christ, following Christ in their personal lives?
Well, what most pastors and ministry leaders don't realize is how feminine so much of what we do appears to a man. And so I encourage, as a first step, just walk through the church and look how it's decorated. I mean, does it look like it was decorated by grandma, or does it look like a place where men gather? Now, you don't have to put neon beer signs in the sanctuary, but I do know churches that have mounted animal heads that hunters have taken.
That's
in their sanctuaries,
cool.
And they've immediately seen an uptake, an increase in men.
Right.
I heard a woman was objecting to this, and he says, you know, and the pastor looked at her, he says, how many quilts are there in the Bible? None. Well, how many dead animals? They're on every page of the Old Testament. So how does the church look? Men are visual. They walk in and if they see a space that's highly feminized, they will immediately believe that this is something for their wives and kids and their grandmothers. Police your language. Look at the songs you're singing. Is it all Jesus, you're my boyfriend, I'm so passionate, I want to make love to you? Is that the feel of our worship? Do our songs make us sound like we're heading to the bedroom or to the battlefield? So that would be one thing. And then, of course, the sermons you preach. If you're a pastor, you should be very wary about continually preaching about family and relationships. Create a sermon series that are titled that men would want to invite their friends, you know, money, sex, and power, you know, dominance, these sorts of themes, survival, these sorts of themes that appeal to men. Adopt those in your teaching and you'll see more men showing up. And then just on a practical level, this is going to be true for men or women in the future. I just this morning read an article that says the dominant platform now for video consumption on earth is TikTok. Mm. More people are watching video on TikTok than any other platform on earth.
Wow.
And the average TikTok is 37 seconds.
Yep. That's because they're getting sucked into Instagram and Facebook too. So TikTok is now taking over the social media world.
It is. It is the future of communication. So what I say to pastors now is if you cannot say it in 30 seconds, your voice is going to be drowned out.
Yep.
So pastors, you must shorten your messages and you must learn ways to clip material out and repurpose it on social media.
Yep.
This is what pastors aren't getting. And if I could do a quick promo for what I've got coming up, I am going to be teaching pastors how to be doing this in a coaching ministry that I call the online video coach or the online preaching coach. And I'm going to launch that in January of 2021. I'm going to be taking 12 pastors under my wing and I'm going to be teaching them everything I know about video communication, being a television producer. And my goal is in 6 months to have 12 guys out there who are killing it on video and are bringing thousands of people to Christ. Because right now the format that we have committed to, the 40-minute monologue, is on its way out. And if pastors want to reach the culture, I hate pastors just hate that. It sets their teeth on edge because that's where they get into the ministry. I want my 40 minutes. But you've got to be thinking evangelistically. You've got to go where the people are, where the young people are, where the lost are. And they are on YouTube and TikTok. And when we begin competing and we have to compete in that marketplace or we're going to lose a generation.
Do you have a URL for that we can post, Dave?
It's going to be at davidmurrow.com.
Okay.
Yeah, if you check my blog, I've got a prototype invitation there right now. I'm still tweaking the language, but later on, you should take a look at that on my blog.
I have to say at this point, Dave, that you started by talking about, you know, walk around your church as a pastor and take a look at the decor, take a look at the songs that you're singing. Some pastors are like me. I had a huge blind spot here. When I first read your book, I was like halfway through and it dawned on me that I had missed most of this and I had been in church my whole life. And the reason was, I think that, you know, I was a typical church guy. I like to sing, you know, I sang in church choir at an early age. I was an acolyte when I was 8 years old, you know, just, I liked being involved in church. And so this stuff didn't faze me. The fact, you know, and well, I went to church that sang mostly hymns, so I didn't get the Jesus, you know, Jesus, I love you music. But when I read your book, I suddenly put myself in the position of, you know, not me, but let's say a blue collar guy who isn't real familiar with church walks in and I was just struck by how weird most of the stuff we did in church was and how feminine it was. But I had missed all that. So I think a fair number of pastors may be in the same boat where, you know, they became pastors because they like church, you know, and so they may want to take somebody with them, or they may want to get feedback from some of the men around them because they may miss some of this stuff. And Mike, you may want to comment on this because, I mean, you're a former pastor. Do you think some pastors are like that? They're not going to see this unless they have a little bit of help.
Yeah, especially if that's all they know, if they've grown up in that, that's been their experience. If I hadn't, like, to David, to your point, David, if I hadn't gone from I grew up in a traditional Presbyterian church. White doilies on the table. And yep. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, you too. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And so, but then I made a transition through going on staff and the video production thing at Orchard Hill Church here in the North Hills, and it's an interdenominational kind of more mega church. Mm-hmm. That changed my whole perspective watching that. But it was a little hard though to accept it at first, if I'm honest, because of my traditional background.
Yeah, it takes you out of your comfort zone because you're the Presbyterian kid, right? And I was a Lutheran kid. So I love liturgy. I liked singing hymns. I would harmonize on hymns. I would keep myself awake during the sermons, but, you know, otherwise I really enjoyed church.
And a lot of the hymns were very masculine. You know, they talk about what we're going. The difference is not even the whether it's girly or manly. It's whether hymns talk about what we're going to do.
Right.
Praise songs talk about how we feel. And, you know, men tend to be more mission oriented. Women tend to be more feeling oriented, emotion oriented. Women feel comforted when they have all their people around them and everyone's doing well. Men feel comforted when they know what they're out to achieve. I know these are huge, you know, generalizations, and there are women who are mission oriented. There are men who are feeling oriented. But having said that, the majority of men are going to feel comforted when they know what their mission is. You know, what am I here to accomplish?
Right.
And so I think that has to pervade your organization. You have to be talking about your mission constantly. Men have to feel a sense of progress. You know, when the pandemic hit and church quit, one of the biggest advices I was giving to pastors is you got to be telling people that the church is closed. We can't see each other anymore. Okay. So you have to be telling your members two things. You have to be giving them testimonies of life change so that people know that they're still in the life change business. And you have to be showing them the hands and feet of Jesus serving in the community. You know, so you're constantly placing in front of your members what your church is accomplishing, or they're just going to quit. And we've actually seen huge attrition from the church. Most churches have not even achieved half of their pre-pandemic attendance yet.
Right.
We're seeing this huge withdrawal from church attendance, and it's a terrible thing. On top of this, online views, which were very strong in the wake of the pandemic, are now tailing off. For the first time, pastors are getting a referendum on their preaching ability. And what they're finding is 5-10 minutes in, people are leaving them.
Yeah.
That would never happen in a live sanctuary because it's considered rude. But online, it happens all the time. All it takes is a flick of the finger and you're off to ESPN or TikTok or wherever, something more interesting. And this is one of the reasons that this online preaching coach is on my heart, is because I want to teach pastors how to compete, how to contend for the gospel on a format that is not friendly to a 40-minute monologue.
Right.
We need to be getting the gospel into these channels, and we're failing miserably.
As a former pastor, we need that, David. I mean, the online preaching coach, I'm going to look into that. It's funny, as you mentioned, guys want a mission. They want to accomplish something. They want to see something accomplished. One of the things that as I'm traveling around the country right now, meeting with pastors for CLC, the thing that I'm hearing from them is their challenge to get volunteers to operate in the church. Attendance is down, but almost more, it seems like what's the pain point that's even greater for them is if volunteers aren't there to actually do some of the things in the church now.
Well, I'm with David on this one. I mean, you know, what do you ask me to volunteer for? Because tomorrow I'm doing Habitat for the first time in like 15 years, and I've missed it terribly because I get to go help build somebody's home. You know, I need opportunities like that. I don't want to work children's ministry. I don't want to work the nursery. I don't want to count. Well, I guess I could count money, but I really don't want to. I want to go out and help somebody, you know, and feeding the, you know, working in a soup kitchen or something like that is fine. But that ministry mention of, you know, four guys getting together and fixing the car for a single mom or something like that, I'm all over that. I can't fix cars, but I can hold tools. I can do something, right? I mean, that's what I want to do. And there's so few opportunities at churches for men to do things like that. I think the days are over where it's appealing to serve, quote, in the church, you know, Sunday, you know, helping out on Sunday morning. It's fine being an usher and all that. I need something to do during the week. I'd rather do something affiliated with my church and with other men working alongside them and accomplishing something.
But you can see the double bind the churches are in, because, you know, we want to offer these opportunities, but we have no volunteers to coordinate it. So then it falls in the pastor's lap.
Yeah.
We are in a historic transition. I would say never in the history of the church has the church lost half its members in 1 year.
Right.
Half its participants in 1 year. And some people are rejoicing at this. They say, oh, it's the great winnowing. It's the people that, you know, didn't care about Jesus. These fake Christians. I think a lot of real Christians went out the door as well. What they've done is they have attached to other online preachers who they will never see in person. I know so many people who have started watching Elevation Church and Stephen Furtick. Why? Because he's a great speaker.
Right.
And he's got amazing guns. I mean, he's just talk about a manly man. I mean, it's a guy, you can rip your head off with one without even trying. But yeah, so people are starting to, they're moving away from their local churches and they're attaching to these amazing communicators. And we're seeing the Walmartization of the church.
Yeah.
We're, you know, everything, we're moving away from the mid-sized church. We're going to see boutique churches, little teeny churches of 10 to 15 to 20 people. And then we're going to see these mega online churches. But what's happening to that mid-sized church? Unless you're competing in the online space, you are not going to grow your church. Because here's the other thing too, Pastor. Hear me on this. It used to be that people would look in the phone book for a church or they'd be invited by a friend. Now they are checking local pastors out online. And so if your church, if your sermon is not scintillating online, they're not going to try your church. You want to advance in your career. Pastor nominating committees used to go through stacks of resumes. Now they go to YouTube. Mm-hmm. If you are not communicating well online, you have no future, you have no career, and in 5 years, you will have no church. So, Pastor, this is why I'm doing online preaching coach, is we need good, solid biblical teaching, but it has to be delivered in a format and with a level of interest that gains the attention of the culture. And right now, so many pastors are floundering in that effort.
That's sobering, but I think there's a lot of truth to that, David. I really appreciate that challenge. One last question I have is, I have also encountered this movement of the church recently moving out. And so now I know some churches like in North Carolina, here in Western Pennsylvania, I've seen them too, where they're no longer as tied into the church building and meeting together in a service, but they're out in the community and their meetings are happening in homes, or they're intentionally entering into certain social spaces like gyms, or coffee shops, things like that, in order to minister to people there. I'm curious, what do you think? Do you think men will grab a hold of that? Or do you? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it's dangerous. It's missional. It's, you're talking about the Francis Chan model. You'd come together once a month for group teaching and singing, but your main emphasis is these smaller groups. Yeah, I do. I do think that's going to be one future manifestation of the church. It's also, and if persecution comes, I would say this distributed church model is going to be much less subject to government sanction than the model that we have now. So I really hate to put any sort of limit on God. And when I hear of these new things, my mind is very open and my heart is very open to see what God does through them. So if your church wants to meet in a bar, wants to meet at a meet in a gym, meet at a mechanic shop, you know, if you want to take church to the world, then I say go for it. And I think the men will get that even more than the women do.
But then I also think, to your point, if it's distributed like that, it reemphasizes or re-highlights the significance of the online communication.
Right. Well, absolutely. Right? Yeah. Cause that's where you're going, that's going to be your main draw. It's not going to be an assembly on Sunday morning. It's going to be social media. It's going to be short videos, things that you post that people see, pick up and share virally. And it's going to be a challenge as we make this transition, but I certainly hope. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's going to make this less appealing to women though, is women have for the past 30, 40, 50 years have spearheaded the move to church because of the discipleship of their children. Now, if your church is meeting in a bar or meeting at a gym, how do you do children's ministry? The fact is you don't.
Right. Yeah.
Now, what I would say to those moms is don't worry. If dad is being transformed, if you're being transformed, you don't need a children's ministry. Your children just need to see you becoming kinder, gentler, more filled with the Spirit than to hear, you know, yet another story of Zacchaeus climbing a tree. The first is going to be so much more powerful than the latter. So if you want to do a distributed church out in the community, that's a great way to do it. Don't worry about your kids. They will follow your example way more than what they're taught in Sunday school.
Well, your online preaching coaching is going to help in this area too, because if a pastor can get a message boiled down to 30 seconds or a couple of minutes that's video appropriate, who's going to be able to pick up on that? The dads are, the fathers are, the men are going to pick up on that. And then who are they going to turn to? They're going to turn to their kids and say, hey, here's what I learned today, and pass that down. So that's the perfect teaching, right? I mean, you don't need an hour of children's programming. You've got dad telling you something that he just learned today.
Yeah, it's, and you know, social media is perfect format for that. Hey, look, this pastor cracking egg on his head to illustrate, you know, embarrassment or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, this is the other thing that pastors don't understand is that we've become a visual culture. Mm-hmm. There is no place now in our society where people sit down for 40-minute lectures. Even colleges and universities are moving away from that model mm-hmm. and going toward experiential learning. So pastors were being left behind. It's our love for the pulpit that's leaving us behind. And so what I'm going to be doing is challenging pastors to, yes, you still want your 40-minute sermon, that's fine, but it has to break down into smaller pieces. There has to be stronger visual content so that you can compete in this visual medium. Mm-hmm. If it's just you standing there with a black Bible, nobody's going to watch that. So it's just, it's a challenge to get people, pastors reoriented around this because they really do love the pulpit. They love, if I be honest, they love the spotlight. When you ask a pastor, why did you get into the ministry? What do they say? I was called to preach. I mean, that's, yep. that's their focus. Yep. It's not, I was called to lead meetings or I was called to, you know, clean toilets or whatever. No, I was called to preach. They see themselves as preachers. And so mm-hmm. I'm threatening them by saying, you have to alter the way you preach. But the mm-hmm. pastors that are doing that are being rewarded with huge online presence, huge impact, and the leading of souls to Christ. And that for me is the payoff. It's not my 40 minutes in the pulpit. It's lives changed. Hmm.
David, this has been an amazing conversation, man. Thank you so much. You've left us with a ton of value, a ton to think about too, for pastors and men alike. And we're already starting to transition to some extent into this other book that you wrote, Drowning in Screen Time. And so we'll have to have you back on and we'll talk more about that because I know there'll be overlap with this subject. So
yeah, I would love to talk about that. That because that is a huge and growing issue inside and outside of the church. Getting control, you know, just a real brief teaser for that one, I would say, is that a study that was done before the pandemic found that the average North American spends 9 hours a day on screens. And a study from Lifeway Research found that Christians spend less than 5 minutes a day reading the Bible. So it's 5 minutes versus 9 hours. Wow. Who's discipling our people? So right. That with that little teaser, that's what we're going to be unpacking when we talk about drowning in screen time in another edition of this podcast.
Yes, man. David Murrow, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.